This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, as usual on Friday mornings. And today we have we're going to do a little differently than we normally do. We have two different topics. One is about a film release of particular topical importance to be showing in South Africa next week. And the other is a conversation about the budget bill and the implications of the wrangling over it and why, in fact, the budget speech didn't happen. And we'll do that one after we do our first interview. Today, our program we have Samara Pierce, and she is a filmmaker. And the reason why we're talking to her is that she was involved in the film Family Album, Uwaza, I think it is pronounced, or no, the film is Family Album, and the Ukrainian Association of South Africa and the Ukrainian Embassy are instrumental in bringing the film here, and it's in in Pretoria on the 24th of February and in Cape Town on the 27th. And it includes photography that was uncovered by Samara Pierce. And it's about the Holodomor. And many people, if you're in Ukraine, you know what the Holodomor is, obviously. But the rest of the world probably doesn't know it quite so well, and so that's why we're going to talk about it. Samara, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Do us all a favor. Give us a very quick introduction as to what, in fact, the Holodomor was and why its relevance continues to the present.
So Holodomor began in 1932. It was Stalin's way of implementing a five-year plan. He didn't like the idea of farm owners, so he would take away farms to make larger collective farms. And because the Ukrainian people had a resistance against this, they were forced into starvation. So Stalin would do things like set up military personnel around villages, and you could have a passport to get in and out. Otherwise, you were left in the village to perish. There was no help coming. There was no discussion of this outside of Ukraine during that period. We had Theodore Cardinal Anitza from Austria who tried to speak of it at the time. But all in all, it would have been against the law to photograph in Ukraine during this period. It would have been seen very much as a negative thing to do. You would have been arrested for photographing. And that's why it was quite interesting that my great-grandfather, Alexander Winneberger, who lived in Kharkiv at the time, which was a very hard-hit area, would go around and photograph. So he photographed the span from people first seeing people die of starvation on the streets and an interest in that, in being surprised to see this death. And then everybody became affected. It meant that it became a part of everyday life, that you would see mothers with their children who hadn't survived. You would see the men who perished first. And then people became desensitized to it and would walk past dead children in the streets without batting an eyelid. And this went on for nearly 2 years before Stalin gave up. And the problem was with the second year of why it made it so bad in 1933, was in 1932, not only did they take all the food, but they took any way of growing any more crops. All the seed was taken. And this wasn't necessarily, there's a lot of talk about how this was done for just the five-year plan and for money and for development. But in actual fact, a lot of food would sit and go moldy, be eaten by rats. It was just a way of punishing people of Ukraine for standing up to the policy of the five-year plan.
One of the things I've discovered over the years as I've done various kinds of research work on international relations issues and especially historical relations between the then Soviet Union and the rest of the world. The reporting in international newspapers of major reputation, the New York Times among others, was that the reporting about the famine and the magnitude of it was virtually non-existent at the time. And the reasons for it are varied, but what I'm getting at is that in the 30s, in the 1930s, reporting on this kind of horrific event, if it wasn't in the newspapers or possibly a radio broadcast by somebody, then effectively it wasn't part of the historical record for most people. The situation today, of course, is very different. Everybody's a citizen journalist, and if a bomb is shot at anything, anywhere, somebody probably is pointing a cell phone at it, and that material, that information, rockets around the world, and we know about it. We know much more about what happens in small villages in Ukraine now as a result of the Russian assault than we ever did about the famine that your work deals with. Now, you did not do this film alone, obviously. The movie Family Album, as I understand it, was written and directed by Marina Takuchik, which I assume is a Ukrainian person. Am I right? And
Yes, she is. So
so.
we had a full Ukrainian team from the production down to the sound man. The most fantastic team I've ever worked with, I must say. But going back to your previous point about Ukraine, the famine being talked about at the time, the similarities there are, so there's a similarity with food being used as a weapon. This time, the weapon is mining fields, so you can't sow more seed. And there are starving people in Ukraine, certainly under occupation. But the similarities with the information getting out is that, yes, we have the internet. This is the most documented war there ever was. However, what Stalin done in 1933 was he paid off Walter Duranty to tell lies to the New York Times.
I
And
was going to
that's very
get to
similar.
that, but you did. You did for
Sorry.
me. Thank you. No, that's fine. I gave you the lead and you ran with it. And that's a black mark against the New York Times for sure.
I'm not too sure if they understood, but certainly a black mark against Walter Duranty. I don't know if it was a wider conspiracy, but certainly he was paid. And very obviously so when you look back on it. But I'm not from the 1930s, so I don't know how that felt at the time. But in
Neither am I.
hindsight.
I'm sorry. I'm older than you, but I'm not quite that old.
So yes, there are similarities where the disinformation, what they do with the truth now, as the truth can get out, disinformation and misinformation, flooding the information plane is what they do to cause the same problems. I have a lot of people that tell me Holodomor is fake, you're a part of the your family made it up, it's a conspiracy. But thankfully, we have so much evidence that we don't need to listen to that kind of misinformation. But it is easy to spread it online, unfortunately, for people that don't know anything about Holodomor.
Well, I mean, one of the great phrases, great in the sense of large as opposed to good or appropriate, it's got to be true. I saw it on the internet, which means that any bit of disinformation, if it's suitably put together and expertly made, can be very similar to the truth, unless or to reality, unless you know what's going on. Let's do a little bit of the magnitude of this famine. We famines are the kinds of things that they're not natural disasters, quick and dirty. They're slow and inexorable. People get hungry, people starve, and eventually people die. And then the weaker members of that society die off first, along with children and elderly people, and then eventually everybody else. But I have seen numbers that speak to a range of between 2.5 and 3.5 million victims. Is that accord with what you know?
No, that is a very new thing that started happening. Very disappointingly, I hear it a lot in Ukraine, but to me, that's Russian propaganda. It is almost impossible to tell the real numbers for sure. I get that, and I understand why there is a discrepancy between them. The reality is that the top number is up to 10 million, but that's including babies not being born because of people dying. To me, I would say between 6 and 8 million from the information I've read on people's witness statements of how many people they saw die in their villages. And then you try and spread that out. So my great grandfather in particular, he saw a grave site that could hold 250,000 bodies. And in each grave dug, there were 250 people. When that this was just one area in Kharkiv. Yes, it was the capital at the time, and it would have suffered greatly. But people in Bu, and this was the whole of Ukraine, not just one area. So to me, the new thing that started coming out is 4 million. People started saying 4 million, and I don't know why this has become the new number. I do not trust anybody that says 4 million,
Well,
because that's very
as
under.
Stalin is reputed to have said, one death is a tragedy and a million deaths is just a number. Unfortunately, we're going to have to take a station break and we'll be right back with our conversation with Samara Pierce after these messages. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and we'll be right back. And please, in that old phrase, don't touch this dial. We'll be right back with you.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and I'm speaking with Samara Pierce, filmmaker, photographer, and the person behind the movie Family Album, which chronicles the mass death in Ukraine in the 1930s as a result of the 5-year plan that in the process killed off a generation of people in Ukraine. We're talking numbers, and quite reasonably, the range of numbers is large, but it is certainly in the millions, and that in itself deserves astonishment, I guess. It's certainly in the last, well, since I went to university, we went through a cycle of many people on the left side of things continued to salute the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution in China. And then eventually it became clearer that many millions of people died in the process in China. What is it about famines and these kinds of unnatural disasters that both it appeals to dictators and horrifies those of us who have to watch it and mystifies us as we somehow can't manage to believe it?
It's very difficult to imagine what that would look like and or having to experience that yourself. As far as people willing to do it, I think it's ruling by fear, and starved people are easy to rule. They're easy to control. They would do it quite a lot, certainly during World War II as well, where they would make people walk very, very long distances to work. And that was just to wear them down so they couldn't revolt. So I think when you have a very large population like China, for instance, it would be beneficial to a dictator to have a weak population that are willing to do as they're told for a few calories.
Yeah, I mean, I shouldn't say the word fascinates me. And sort of, it fascinates me, I guess, the way a mongoose and a cobra eye each other.
A
But
psychological fascination in how we managed to do this. I can't put my mind to the people that do this. I can put my mind to the people that feel the suffering of others. This is a reason why I hold Ukraine so close. You know, I've been to Ukraine. I've met these people that went through these situations. One lady I met, she said the only reason she survived was because she was 5 years old. And when she got to the bread queue, people would let her go in front because the bread would run out before the queue was finished. So a lot of people would starve for that reason. But because she was so small, people allowed her to survive. And that kindness, when you hear that, you can understand that suffering.
one of the things that's happening in our world today that the film that you've been involved in should be something of a warning or a foreboding for I guess. In Sudan now, in North Central Africa, the reports that I have read from sources such as the International Rescue Committee speak to at least 10 million people on the raw edge of starvation. I mean, that's almost an inconceivable number. That's the population of a very large city or a small country. And then you add in the millions of people who are now refugees, either internally or domestic or internationally, plus tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of deaths as a result of the combat. You have an extraordinary global catastrophe, and yet you see almost no documentation of it, even though we live in this connected world. We live in this electronicized world. We live in this world in which people report everything. Sudan seems to have missed the gaze of most people. Speculate on that, please.
I think maybe the people that are there don't have the technology to record it for themselves. I think that's the difference between Sudan and Palestine, was the people in Palestine had recording devices. People are also maybe fearful of going to Sudan about being able to navigate the country themselves. I have seen a few people, a few like content creators that do film in Sudan who work with charities who try to promote this idea. There's potential. There's a bit of fear, maybe, from our involvement in African countries before, certainly in the West, and not doing a very good job of it and interfering with that area. But Sudan is very problematic. It's multifaceted. It's not one problem, it's multiple issues coming together. I certainly wouldn't know how to improve that situation for anybody. And I
I
don't
mean,
know if many people would have an answer for that.
one of the things that I think about the circumstances with Gaza, and I've been to that part of the world, that if you are a reporter for a large, reputable international news gathering institution, you can report on circumstances, disaster in the Gaza territory itself, and that by dinner time, you're in a nice hotel in Tel Aviv. Which makes it very different than reporting on the disaster of Sudan and having no way to go for shelter, for sustenance, and for protection. And it's all very problematic. I've seen a couple of things on international news channels who report, intrepid reporters who actually do it. And I've read some stories in magazines like The Economist, which cover it in detail. But in my mind, it's one of the great underreported stories of our time, similar in some ways to the disaster, the famine in Ukraine in the 1930s that your film profiles. And yet, there does not seem to be much in the way of making these things stop. Human behavior doesn't necessarily encourage us to believe this can be stopped.
No. I think people are very much, certainly at the moment, are focusing on themselves. The world is becoming a bit more of a scary place, and the speed of that seems to be picking up quite rapidly. And everybody is talking about themselves. When the war happened in Ukraine, people in England were very much, well, what about me? Because we couldn't use Russian gas anymore, and our bills were going up at a time where our bills were already getting quite high. So it became very much, what about me? They couldn't put themselves in a position where they were thinking, actually, I might have to pay a bit more. I might have to have a bit less in my life, but it means that I'm saving a Ukrainian child and her mother. They can't necessarily link those two, especially when it's not a direct link. Not using Russian fuel has no direct bearing on how many missiles Russia is going to send into Ukraine. It does over a long period of time financially if it impacts their economy, if they can't diversify their economy. But that's not what the people are thinking directly. Whereas Sudan, I think that's it's huge, and it's not in our even in our periphery. In America, things that happen in America are very much impacted on us. Things that happen in Sudan have no impact on people in the Western world. So I think it's very hard. Even when Gaza happened, I think that was a turning point for a lot of people in talking about the Middle East and things outside of our normal sphere of information. And with that came a lot of people talking about the Congo, talking about Sudan, and a lot of these groups were attaching themselves to this momentum that was going on for Gaza. And they'd done a very good job with doing that on social media. However, the momentum never stays with any war, with any conflict, even with Gaza, with watching things weren't getting better. But after a year, people. They can't consume that material all the time. It becomes very disheartening and soul destroying to fight against this system that you know you cannot win. So, for instance, again in Gaza, I apologize to keep bringing up this subject, but when you want your government to do something and you realize your government is not going to work for you, they're not going to believe a majority of people in. Not a large majority, but still a majority in England did not believe that women and children should be killed in Gaza as a result of what happened. However, our government didn't see it that way, and they believed that only Israel had the right to defend themselves. And although they are 100% correct that, yes, Israel 100% should defend themselves, they should still be condemned for attacking women and children. And that was when a lot of people around the world realized that our governments don't actually speak for the people. A lot of people already knew that, but the masses didn't know that.
Samara, we're going to have to wrap up, but let me reprise what we've been talking with Samara Pierce about. There is a new film. Well, I don't quite know precisely how new, but it's new for here, certainly. Family Album, which draws on photographs and I guess interviews as well with some survivors. Family Album, which draws on photographs of one of your ancestors of the Great Famine in Ukraine, the officially designated and developed and created famine in the 1930s. And it will be shown in Pretoria on the 24th of February and Cape Town on the 27th. Do you know precisely where it's being shown? My notes don't tell me this.
Yes, it's at the Labia Theatre.
In Pretoria?
I'm not too sure in Pretoria. Sorry. It should be on
Okay,
their
well,
website.
it'll be it we'll be able to find out, and next week we'll be able to announce it where it is. Anyway, I want to thank you very much for sharing some time with us. Unfortunately, the film is not going to be in Johannesburg. What a shame. I wish I could see it here.
Yes, that would be better.
Will it be available online anywhere?
It should be in time available online. Once all the screenings have gone through, then it should be going online.
Okay, well then I'll watch for it online as soon as I can. Family Album, The Holodomor in Ukraine, and if viewers go see it, they need to keep in mind, in my feeling, with the contemporary resonances with other such dreadful circumstances in Eastern Europe, in the Middle East, and in Africa, even now as we speak. Samara Pierce, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.